Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Welcome to Breaking Banks, the number one global fintech radio show and podcast with over 6 million unique listeners in 177 countries. I'm JP Nichols, and I'm here this week with Jason Henricks. Today, we're going to explore some new strategies for growth in financial services. Beyond the traditional loans, deposits, and payments, where are those greenfield opportunities? Jason, you've got an interesting conversation coming up. Why don't you talk about the interview?
Yeah, so Ron Shevlin, longtime regular contributor and friend of ours, had an article in Forbes around JP Morgan Chase entering the point of sale lending space, something that traditionally banks have not played at. There's a couple that have, but not very many. And so Sandeep Bhandari, chief strategy officer for Affirm, the leading e-commerce point of sale lender, joined us to talk about trends. And one of the most interesting aspects as we talked about this is really thinking about this, that it isn't just about it being a loan, but this is actually, it's a payment vehicle. And just strategically how banks need to reframe how they think about lending and payments and this idea of embedded commerce. And you know, it was really interesting as we talked about this, the entire concept of disintermediation and how the pieces can come back together. Great conversation with the two of them.
Well, we've been talking a lot about strategy off the air in the past couple of weeks. You were busy with a board and senior leadership team of a bank, and I was with the board of one of the banking schools. And you know, what's your favorite line about strategy?
Well, I mean, something I had picked up in my time working at Monitor with Michael Porter was it's not a strategy unless somebody else would willfully choose to do the opposite. You know, when we talk to banks, how sick are you of hearing, it's like, you know, what's your competitive advantage? Well, it's our relationships. Well, if everyone's competitive advantage is their relationships, you know, who are the loser banks out there who don't have any relationships and how are they winning?
Right.
You know, far too often we meet with these banks and we talk about strategy. What they really have is a to-do list, not really a strategy and certainly not a differentiated strategy. And things about disintermediation and the rebundling of how these things fit, that's really where strategy comes into play.
No, that's why it's so interesting to think about some of these things like POS lending. And then in the second half of the show, I'm going to talk with Richard Turin about his new book. It's called Innovation Lab Excellence, Digital Transformation from Within. And we'll talk about how innovation labs can and should be used for exploring new areas of growth. What are some of the best practices and what gets in the way for some of those?
Well, in you know, the concept of a lab, you know, it really has kind of started to pique in interest within financial services right now. And there's a danger in a lab that it is a great place to explore, to create some of those best practices. But if that's where the banks actually stop, you know, to steal one of your phrases, it's great that banks are now starting to go to Finovate. But if you're going to your sixth Finovate and it actually hasn't changed any of your behaviors, that maybe isn't the best use of your resources. And I'd say the same is true of the labs. If you know, you've got cool beanbags and you know toys for structured thinking and people wearing hoodies, that's good. And it's good to challenge yourselves to think outside of the box. But if you don't actually pull it back in and begin to apply it in different ways, it probably isn't your best use of resources.
Well, that's right. It's just kind of an R&D research lab. Maybe something will come out of it. Maybe it won't. And really, most banks can't afford something like that. Well, I'm going to kind of keep this a little bit short because we have a lot of great content today. Today's show is brought to you by the Alloy Labs Alliance, a member-driven shared innovation lab that helps regional and community banks reduce risks, lower costs, and shorten the time between ideas and results. Banks can find out more information or apply to join at ftforge.com/alloy. And just a couple of conference announcements. The Financial Brand Forum is next week, April 15th through 17th. Over 2,000 senior leaders with more than 750 financial institutions will be heading to Las Vegas for the world's largest and most elite conference in the banking industry on marketing, customer experience, data analytics, and digital transformation. You can get your tickets if there are any left at financialbrandforum.com. Jason, on the 24th, you're going to be speaking at the FDIC's FinTech and Future of Banking Conference in D.C. Why don't you talk about that?
Yeah, it was very excited. You know, normally when you get a call, it was like, this is the FDIC, you cringe. You know, no one likes the call from the regulators.
Cease and desist.
Yeah, the C&D, it's like, once I'm like, oh, wait a second, we don't operate a financial service business anymore. Okay, we're good. But it's a very interesting format because it pulls together a combination of researchers and not just the academic side, but those who are looking at the practical application, and then people from industry itself. And the format is they'll have two or three papers presented, and then they'll have someone, you know, like me or Amaeus Garrity from QED, our good friend Penny Crossman from American Banker, will actually give our response to, you know, here's the theory and what, you know, their research suggests, and here's how we actually see it playing out in the real world.
Well, that is an interesting format. On that same day, on the 24th, I'll be in the Twin Cities at the Minnesota Bankers Association Operations and Technology Conference. That starts a busy stretch for me, too, because on the 29th, I'll be at the Baker Hill Conference in Nashville, then on the 30th at the ABA Community Bank Council in Savannah. So come say hi if you're at any of those events. If you have something you want to share with our audience, hit us up on Twitter at BreakingBanks1 or email us at info@provoke.fm.
Here with Ron Shevlin and Sandeep Bhandari of Affirm, talking about actually a great topic that very timely around point of sale financing. A few weeks ago, JPMorgan Chase announced they were entering a space that has actually seen the most innovation driven by fintech companies. Ron, I was a little bit surprised by some of your data in there about how few banks are actually playing in that space. And the names of the four that are the largest weren't kind of the usuals before Chase, that it was Citizens and Fifth Third, Regions and Synovus were the ones seeing the greatest growth within point of sale loans. What do you make of that trend in terms of both why point of sale is going up and why aren't banks participating?
Yeah, so a couple of things here, Jason, to that point. I think one of the big reasons why you don't see a lot of names on that list is because it really kind of takes a specialized group within the bank to kind of go after this. And this is not general consumer lending. This is really going after merchants first, in many cases, to develop relationships. So Citizens is actually the bank behind Apple's point of sale financing. It takes more of a commercial relationship to go after this. So you tend to see the relationships more in the large banks. Now, you would think you'd see it with some of the community banks who are very commercial focused. But again, because it's ultimately consumer lending, it's not a big area for them. But this is really important, and one of the reasons why I wanted to kind of bring this up and bring this to light is especially around the fact that from a consumer perspective, you know, for so many financial institutions, whether they're banks or credit unions today, payments strategy and payments revenue is so important that because consumers now have another option in their payments mechanism to kind of go point of sale financing versus using a credit card, that this is becoming kind of important, I think, to, or should be more important to a lot of financial institutions. And, you know, when I asked in a recent survey of financial institutions what's on top of their list from a payments and lending perspective, point of sale financing was nowhere close. And I think that that's a potential strategic oversight in many of their parts.
I hadn't thought about it. It isn't just a financing vehicle. It really is becoming a payment vehicle in the conducting of that commerce. Sandeep, I'm curious, in a firm's, you know, perspective, you know, how would you respond to that, you know, in terms of the growth you've seen in that B2B2C? And do you think of yourself dually as a lender as well as a payments vehicle?
Yeah, no, I think a lot of what Ron was saying here resonates deeply with me. You know, one of the things that is very important to recognize here is that what in point of sale financing, we are actually facilitating payments for merchants first and foremost, while at the same time providing a different kind of lending, a more transparent, a more controllable sort of lending option for consumers. So if I think about it from the merchant's first approach that that Ron was talking about, I think not only do we need some commercial orientation and sales focus to go figure out which merchant verticals to go after and what kind of use cases to really offer the product at. But also there's a technological component here. The way to integrate with merchants actually differs a fair bit depending upon the kind of merchant and the kind of channel. The physical space is very different from the e-commerce space. And, you know, in case of large merchants, they may actually have more bespoke requirements. In some cases, we are able to do deep API integrations. In most of our cases, that's a preferred way. But in other cases, we actually use more lighter integration approaches. So I think that's one other piece that has actually given the fintech an edge here compared to the traditional banks, or especially the smaller banks, where the technology element here is quite substantial. And then we can talk more about the consumer piece, but I think just the transparency of the product and the changing preferences relative to credit cards is actually a really important piece that's actually making this happen more now than any other time.
Yeah, let's go into that, the consumer piece of this. With point of sale financing on the rise, I'm curious what you think is driving that. Is it a substitution from credit? Are people just taking on a lot more debt maybe than they should be? Is it giving access to debt that maybe those who didn't have access before? What's driving the rise?
Yeah, I mean, like with most things, it is a combination of different things. And frankly, for us, for me personally, one of the things that is most important is to make sure that we aren't letting consumers get too indebted, because there is a way in which point of sale financing is really a good thing, and the use cases are very appropriate for the kind of lending that we do, where there is predictability of paying off that loan over 3, 6, 12 months. So if you take two extreme examples, right? I mean, let's say you want to buy a car versus you want to pay for your coffee. We don't quite think of buying cars over credit cards, right? There's a reason why a predictable loan over whatever duration that is, 4 years, 5 years, is what we prefer, and it's a substantial outlay. People deliberate about it, plan about it, budget about it, and they take a loan that is more specific to that kind of purchase. And I think for us, and that is the space where we play in, which is the more deliberate kind of purchase. When you're thinking about buying a bedroom set or planning a family vacation, a lot of those situations, point of sale financing product is actually a preferred product. And as we've seen over the course of last 10 years, where consumer preferences have changed, where people are spending more, those are the kinds of things that are coming up. People are actually spending more on their applications. Fitness is one of them. Travel is another one, for example. DIY home improvement. Those are sorts of areas that are coming up more and more that lend themselves very well for this kind of a financing product. And I think the other aspect here that is important to recognize is an element of changing consumer preference that we are seeing. And I think, you know, the generational shift aspect of it is probably talked about, a fair bit, but there is something to be said about the fact that there is greater recognition, whether that is because of the things that regulatory agencies have put on for, or things that consumers have realized as a result of the aftermath of the recession or whatever else. People understand what the substantial and sometimes hidden costs of credit card financing are, and are seeking more control and more transparency around what they're paying when they're borrowing.
So Ron, I'd love to hear your thought. Let's break this into two parts. The first one around the rise in the financing. The second is the shift in preferences and the aspects around regulatory preference. But what do you think is driving the increase in point of sale financing?
I would say, to a very large extent, it's all about the improvement in the user experience. You've got to remember that not all point of sale financing relates to online or digital purchases. Here's an example of where point of sale financing is kind of increasing thanks to technology, but not through online. Your water heater in your house goes and you need a new one, and the guy shows up to look at your water heater and says, yeah, I can replace it. It's going to be $1,200. Well, you don't have $1,200 cash. You may need to get some sort of financing for it. You know, a couple of years ago, you were kind of stuck. You told the guy, come back in a few days, let me see what I can do. Today, the guy's got an iPad. He can plug in a few pieces of information and give you point of sale financing right on the spot. And that's not to take away from the improvement in the online experience when we're talking about e-commerce, because thanks to a lot of players like Affirm, you know, we're bringing some sophisticated data and analytics capabilities to the table. They're able to make the point of sale financing decision almost very incredibly seamless and part of the online purchase experience. So it's easy. It's really being driven a lot by the user experience. And I think, as Sandeep said, and I would reinforce it 100%, is the demographic shift. You've got tens of millions of millennial consumers who've come of age in the past 10 years who are relying on these technologies and starting to make purchases and need credit. And so it's, I think that's what's driving a lot of this demand.
Yeah, Sandeep, I'm curious from your point of view, you know, Affirm was founded specifically to go after the underserved or underbanked millennial. Which came first, the chicken or the egg, and giving them access because banks weren't willing to underwrite them? Or was it that they were already on mobile devices and doing things digitally and you could crack that? Because there's an interesting, you know, which was actually the critical driver, you know, that propelled Affirm forward.
Yeah, I mean, if I have to pick between the two, I think it's more the latter. The fact that we recognize there were people who were buying mattresses at Casper's and buying, you know, exercise equipment online or bicycles that they were passionate about or gaming PCs or whatever else. And that was all reflective of the kind of preferences consumers were showing for the type of purchase they were making, the channel at which they were buying, what they wanted to do in terms of how quickly they wanted to be done with the financing aspect, because that wasn't the core of what they really wanted to be spending time on. So that would be my take.
How is it going to work on the digitally led with what you're rolling out with Walmart and going to have point of sale financing available online and at, what is it, about 4,000 Walmart stores? How does that functionally work? I kind of envision it's almost like the digital version of I'm buying the couch and they say, how'd you like, you know, 0% interest for 6 months sort of thing. But what's it going to look like in the use case within Walmart?
It's actually a real neat piece of integration, and we're really excited about this partnership with Walmart. Essentially, what customers can do is check their eligibility through affirm.com/shop/Walmart before even heading into the store. And while they shop, you know, they can do that using their mobile device or even the desktop. And the decision is made real time. Again, you know, similar to what we do, doesn't impact their credit score. And once they approve, they select the repayment term of 3, 6, 12 installments, shown the exact repayment amount they owe each month. What they then do is they receive a unique barcode that is scanned by a store associate at the register, and that's how they complete the purchase.
Ron, this connects back to your point. You know, that barcode now is actually a payment vehicle, not just a financing vehicle. And the payment is embedded in a broader set of experiences in terms of where it's going on. Do you think banks are going to wake up to this, that, you know, they're not just missing the financing aspect? This is going to be hitting their payment rails as well?
I think it's going to hit them and they're not even going to know it, because they're not going to see where the shift in payment behavior is coming from. It's coming from so many different angles. This is just going to be one of them. And honestly, I think they're just not, it won't be visible enough to them to say, wow, point of sale financing is kicking us in the butt. It's coming from so many different angles, I think they're going to miss it.
Sandeep, I'd love your thoughts on that, because I'm assuming, you know,
yeah, no, that's exactly
you,
right.
you come from, you know, a banking background. Do you stand out at the conferences? Like, are they not even going to the same places you are and having these discussions?
I agree with Ron that there is a shift that is happening, and it, in the broader banking community, it's not being recognized at a pace that supposed they should recognize it at. And of course, you know, there are some progressive banks that we are seeing taking some action. But yeah, the payments landscape is changing very rapidly. Mobile optimized experiences is another big aspect of it that I think the banks are a little late to catch on to. And frankly, there is another aspect of it that's more merchant driven, where merchants are getting more and more cognizant of, they're asking the question of, well, okay, what am I paying for? Where is the value add? They are really drawn to our story of saying, where are we approving more consumers? Some of those consumers that actually are not underwritten as well by traditional underwriting mechanisms. But merchants actually want to see that lift, and they're very willing to pay for that lift to see the substantial amount of increase in their sales. But they want that to be transparent, you know, just one interchange that everybody pays for every kind of consumer is something that is being questioned more and more. And those interchange rates have, in fact, been going up. So the merchants are asking that question of where's the value add, and frankly, are willing to pay more for it, but they want to see that.
Well, speaking of the value add and the merchants wanting to embed this, is Walmart going to embed this in their mobile app, or where are you going to fit? How are they approaching this as they're rolling it out across their ecosystem?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, a little too early for us to be talking about that at this stage, but I think I will say that it is going beyond in-store, and it is going to be a much larger, very strategic relationship between Walmart and us.
I'm curious, as you look across the merchant landscape, Walmart obviously has been doing a lot of partnering with fintechs, interestingly enough. What other merchants do you think are some of the most progressive in how they're thinking about how the financial technology actually impacts the way they do business?
Yeah, so we are seeing this across a wide variety of merchants, very different kinds. And so, you know, among the broadline merchants, Walmart certainly, but we are also seeing some of the other bigger players that we are at different stages of talks with in terms of what we could do there. And those are more of the traditional merchants that we all know about. And then there are specialized ones where they are working very closely with us on saying, hey, how can we market together in different ways and experiment around that? What kind of a funnel placement might work for us? How should we position the financing option differently? And so, you know, Peloton obviously being a great example of that. Casper, those are great partners of ours that have been working with us for a long time and are actually, across different channels, across different kind of marketing and positioning messages, seeing differential impact and working closely with us. And then similarly, there's travel merchants that are, again, some of the bigger airlines that are working with us too in ways where they're testing some of the same aspects in different ways. But we are seeing this engagement from, you know, more mature merchants, newer merchants, and in various different verticals. It's quite a expansive, sort of embracing of point of sale financing that we're seeing right now.
Hey, Sandeep, in addition to competing with the banks in this space, there's a whole bunch of other fintech startups that are in the point of sale financing area. And I'm just wondering, which of your competitors in the space are you watching? Who do you think is doing an interesting job?
You're right. There are actually a lot of interesting competitors here that are doing different things that we watch. So, some of them more squarely competing with us, some of them somewhat in a different space. So, you know, Green Sky is certainly one that we watched. It's a slightly different approach, and they work much more in your water heater example that you talked about is actually a great use case for what they do. We are watching them in that space closely. And then there are others that are, you know, somewhat more similar to us, but they tend to be more category specific, and we are watching them to see, well, what are they doing differently about user experience, and can we actually, how do we continue to make sure that we retain our competitive advantage and just keep a step ahead of that? So both category specific kind of competitors, as well as the likes of Green Sky that we see more in the offline space, are the ones that we're watching.
Ron, I'm curious, when you think about this in the same kind of direction from a banking perspective, who do you think amongst the banks do you look at and say, you know, Chase obviously tends to come in very strong and has a lot of resources to throw around. We've got those four banks we discussed that are doing interesting things. Where do you think the rest of this goes from a banking perspective? Are there going to be new entrants there, or is it going to stick with the four?
Oh, I'm sure we'll see some new ones in, but you know, the Citizens Bank here in the Massachusetts area where I am has really made a strong commitment to this and have built up a lot of capabilities. So I think there's a lot of interesting stuff going on there from Citizens, and I think they're very committed to this. I think part of the challenge, and Sandeep kind of alluded to this at the very beginning when he talked about the need for merchant integration, this takes commitment from a financial institution. But I think what's going to emerge, you know, are some players, and I think they're already emerging, that will provide more of a platform type of concept that will enable more financial institutions to get into it without having to make the direct connections. So, for example, Lone Star Technologies in the Philadelphia area has a platform they call Merchant Link. So as more of those type of players come to market, they'll make it easier for the mid-sized banks and credit unions to kind of get into this market versus the large institutions who kind of have to build it all themselves these days. So I think that platform concept is what's going to help change this market over the next few years.
Well, and you know, talk about two difficult things to integrate. You know, first, point of sale technology, like Sandeep said, it is only beaten in the probably the slowest to adopt and hardest to integrate to by the banking industry itself. And so getting those two things to work together, it does require some new platforms to come in, especially at the point of sale, to make that happen. Sandeep, closing thoughts on where you think the space is going?
Yeah, no, this is super exciting. Look, I think we will continue to see a lot of technological innovations in terms of how we integrate fraud. Another aspect that we didn't talk about, but trying to make sure that you are on top of that is really critical in this space. You know, it's a card not present kind of situation, and sure you have a bit more contextual information from the merchant, but fraud, underwriting, verification, all of that will, again, be a really critical element of competitive advantage here. Where I see this going is, I think we are going to find, and certainly that's something that we are focused on as a firm, new and new purchase categories where we will enable this kind of financing through newer products. You know, some of those products may be more specific to, you know, a fashion industry versus furniture kind of an industry, as an example on the other extreme. Newer channels and frankly going omni-channel across physical and online and providing customers a seamless experience around those different channels, that's going to be another big part of it. I think we're going to see for players like us who are actually gaining relatively good amount of scale now and reinforcement of how that network continues to evolve both on the consumer side and the merchant side and how each side reinforces the other side. And then there is, of course, the aspect of how we take this more globally and think about it beyond beyond United States. I think all of those pieces are vectors of growth that we are really excited about, and it's only a matter of time before we start to see how point of sale financing is actually proliferating in all of those areas.
Well, in that category specific, if we think about it, far too often credit is, especially consumer credit, is a very blunt instrument in terms of what the options are available. And so that category specific, you know, is certainly a very interesting one and in how it becomes embedded in the experience and what it can deliver for you. Ron, parting shots on where you think this industry is going?
I think it's going to explode. I think not only is consumer demand going to drive that, the user experience is driving that, the improvement in data and analytics and doing things that in real time is going to drive that. And then I think the emergence of platforms that help more institutions get into this is going to help drive it as well. So I'm very bullish on this.
Well, Ron and Sandeep, thank you very much for taking time today to talk about a space that I don't think many of us tend to think that much about other than when you're getting that zero interest on that couch for the next 6 months. So thanks for sharing your thoughts on where this is headed.
Oh, wonderful. Thanks for having me. It was great talking to you.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit facebook.com/Voice America.
Yeah.
You're listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
Well, I'm here with Richard Turin, author of Innovation Lab Excellence, Digital Transformation from Within. So, Rich, welcome to Breaking Banks. Tell us a little bit about your background. I know you have a banking background and you ran IBM Cognitive Studios, but tell us more about your background and why you wrote this book.
Sure. I started my career out in banking and I did 20 years on trading floors, not as the guy who says buy, sell, but the guy who actually designs the products. Mm-hmm. So I worked with a team of people who were essentially computer coders. And what we did was what we would now call B2B business. So basically taking computers and taking technology and using them to build products for our clients. So after essentially 20 years or just short of 20 doing that, I moved to China after the financial crisis, which spelled the death of my business, and eventually lined up with IBM, where I ended up heading their innovation labs for fintech down in Singapore. So going ahead to Singapore, what I saw that was really fascinating was that my clients were other innovation labs, because what I sold were IBM's AI product and also their specialist analytics services. What I saw were many young people at the labs who were terribly unhappy. And then on the other side of the equation, I saw senior managers who were responsible for labs not happy with what they saw from the labs. So a career in banking followed by this seeing so many unhappy people working in and around labs.
Well, I share part of your background as a recovering banker myself, and I really enjoyed your book. I thought you brought up a number of excellent points, and you have a number of best practices that you offer for those running innovation labs, and we're going to get into some of those today. Now, before we do that, though, let me just say, but you stayed in Asia, and you're in Shanghai now?
Yes, I've been almost a decade in Shanghai and Singapore. So the actual count is 2.5 years in Singapore and seven and change up here in Shanghai. It's just been a wonderful ride in China. For fintech is the place to be.
Well, that's certainly one of the things Brett talks about all the time on the show, and I don't spend as much time as I'd like, but I'm in Asia at least a couple of times a year, and I come away with the same experience. So it does bring a kind of a certain perspective for looking at innovation and in fintech. Now, in your book, you differentiate between R&D or Skunk Works and your vision of a digital innovation lab. Can you talk a little bit about the difference and what you mean about a digital innovation lab and how that's different?
Traditionally, if we look at a consumer products company, for example, or a food products company, they've had innovation labs where they test flavors or where they test a new product out. Digital innovation labs are perhaps descendants of these organizations, but are fundamentally different. What they strive to do is to bring digital transformation into a company. In what I would like to think is the least painless way possible. But we have to think about digital products as having a very short lifespan, and quick setup time. So what we're looking for is not R&D for a pharmaceutical that takes 10 years to launch a new cancer drug. We're looking at a facility that is designed to bring new digital products up and online within the period of months or shorter, smaller fractions of a year.
So within fintech or financial services, do you think most people are getting that mix right?
Oh, absolutely not. I felt that I was doing a social service by trying to write the book because I saw so many people were unhappy. It's really funny. If you talked to lab people, and particularly the young millennials who are working in the labs, many, many of these millennials are grossly unhappy because they want to do more and they feel that they can't within the structures of the large organizations they're working in.
Is that a function of the structure or the leadership or both?
Yeah, all of the above. It's a function of it's a function first and foremost of expectations and the structure of the organization. So the structure is generally that the Innovation Lab is held as a separate separate unit outside and apart from the business units and the daily money-making activities of the bank. What happens is the Innovation Lab is apart and it's out of touch. And it really doesn't understand what everybody else is doing to make a living in the bank.
But it's a bit of a conundrum because on the other hand, if they're not somewhat separated, then aren't, and you talked about this in your book too, they're kind of dragged into very incremental improvements that just kind of extend the line of business as usual. So how do you get that balance right?
That's the tough part. The issue really comes in with if you don't separate the lab, then you have, say, business people looking over the shoulders of the lag people, and their job is to experiment. So if their experiment fails, people will say, ah, look, the experiment failed. You guys don't know what you're doing, you digital people. So you do want some separation, but a physical separation is great. Having your own space is great. I'm all for this. A physical separation is fine. But that there is an intellectual separation as to the purpose and the mission that the lab has relative to the other business units seems to be one of the larger problems that I see out there. So the labs are not aligned in what their purpose is and how they should be serving and servicing their clients, who are essentially the business units of the bank.
Yeah, we see the same kind of thing and my partner Jason likes to talk about one of the banks that we worked with where the outcome was everybody in the bank knew that anything that came out of the lab, that was a signal to immediately reject it because it must be a bad idea. It was from those disconnected people who the bank had hired separately and managed separately.
Yeah, look, just imagine the following scenario. You're in what is essentially one of the most highly regulated industries in the planet, right? You then hire a bunch of digitally enabled young people. And by and large, most of the lab employees are young. So you then tell them to go be creative. And then when they start turning out ideas, you basically say, oh, well, we couldn't possibly use these ideas because they don't fit into the regulatory spectrum or other constraint by which the business units operate. So you've got sort of you've got this problem where there's a mismatch. So the real solution to this, or one potential solution, is to really get the young people who are in these labs trained up as to what happens in the rest of the bank. So yeah, I've lived and I've seen so many times the exact story that you told, where the rest of the banking group looks at the innovation guys and they say, oh boy, here comes trouble. We're never going to use any of that stuff.
Right. It's guaranteed to be disconnected from the reality of the business and our regulatory needs and so on. And you also talk about, there's a parallel story here in one of your best practices. You say flip the hackathon, and you paraphrase the assessment of several hackathon winners that you talked to, where they said essentially, we had to show everyone in the bank how our system worked. We explained it dozens of times to people in multiple departments, and in the end, we gave away all of our IP and got nothing in return. They wouldn't buy our systems because of compliance issues, but we still had to teach them everything we know. So it doesn't sound like a very good partnership when this is, you know, one of the hottest words in fintech these days, right? We're going to partner with you.
Yeah, you know, I don't know what to do with it, but there's this problem in the hackathon universe, and that is that most of the institutions that host these events really have very little plan for what they're going to do afterwards. And in fact, you can really look at many of these events as nothing more than corporate PR exercises. So they do a hackathon, a bank does a hackathon, they get all these young people, they participate, they launch the videos, they get great publicity, they hail all of the winners as geniuses, and there's no follow-up. There is no money to set the systems up. Better that they just go hire a startup. Yeah, I know they won't get the PR buzz out of it, but as far as contributing and getting something back to the bank, go hire a startup and have them do a POC for $100,000. It'll be a better deal.
Right. This is a cousin to something else you talk about that I talk about all the time. Anyone who hears me on the show, I talk incessantly about innovation theater, and you cite that as one of the reasons that labs fail. It's really kind of related to that same problem, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Well, let's look at it from senior management perspective for a moment. Innovation has value. It has PR value and floats and helps float your stock price, helps create the impression of being progressive. So on one hand, we've got this tremendous drive for the most senior managers of the company to push innovation, to make it really look good. And then on the other hand, there's the reality of innovation, which we just spoke about, which is these young millennial staff who are trying to bring technology in and are, as we discussed, voted the most likely to have your business unit run away from. I mean, because they propose solutions that many of the business unit leaders can't use. So pushing on one side, a pushing on the other side to try to get things done that can't be done, and you've got a stage that's set for unhappiness where one side says we're doing great things and the other side says we can't do anything.
Right. Well, let's talk about some solutions because I think you lay out some good practices in the book. And one of the things that you talk about that I think dovetails into what you're just saying now is the need to calculate ROI. And as you say, doing so in innovative ways should be encouraged. How should innovators think about calculating ROI? Because using the same metrics we use for fully established and mature products is usually not a good method.
Look, there's a lot of discussion within the innovation community about whether ROI is or is not a useful measure. If you're working in the banking environment, there is nothing else. You have to use it. So you have to use ROI, but you have to learn how to use it creatively. And that essentially means using soft numbers, meaning that there's hard dollar numbers, which are clearly equatable to dollars in saved costs for client servicing or from some other metric that is hard and real. But we also have to look at new metrics or softer metrics and to add them into the equation somehow so that they get calculated and they make a contribution. So yeah, you don't want to put any of our innovation products under the boot, if you will, or under the strict constraints of traditional ROI calculation. But of course, you need to be creative and think of other ways to find soft money and benefit and to calculate an imaginary dollar benefit value to those benefits, and that's probably the only way that within a banking institution you're going to get innovation products through the cost and the funding hurdles.
Well, in the book, you cite an example from DBS Bank in Singapore and their Emma chatbot. Can you talk a little bit about that and how they looked at hard and soft dollar ROI?
Yeah, it was a great example. And I think it was OCBC Bank. What they did was
I cited the wrong Singapore bank because I know you talked about DBS as well.
I talk about them both. Emma was a really great example because I got to talk to the sponsor for this. And what they were able to do and what they've been public in doing is citing the number of people who have been served by Emma the chatbot, how many correct answers. And what they've been able to do is to set up a series of metrics that basically give some value to Emma's services. So if anybody is asking the question, should we keep Emma alive and should Emma be paid for? Well, the people who are running it say, look, Emma has answered 2 million questions, 88% of them it's answered correctly, and that saved X number of manpower hours from our call centers where these things would have gone. Now, you can say that the saved hours to a call center, that's a clear, calculable, and hard dollar metric. But the number of correct answers and the number of questions or people served, these are softer metrics. And what the sponsor of the Emma chatbot was able to do to get the project off the ground was to work with these softer metrics and to take soft dollar metrics and use them as the one of the ways that the project would pay for itself.
Well, but at the same time, you talk about, and correctly in my mind, avoid the big plan is one of your best practices. And because you say the big plan is often heavily tech-centric rather than people-centric. And you talk about, you know, not making too big of a bet on any one technology. And I think Emma was an example of technology that they were able to repurpose from prior experiments. But talk a little bit about what are the best practices around avoiding the big plan and maybe an example of who does that well.
You know, it's really funny. There's a lot of labs that are functioning relatively well. And if I was to make one distinction between the labs that function well and those that don't, it would be that the good, well-functioning labs have lots of little projects that are always percolating through the system. And then I'll get to another lab, and that will be the lab that has what I call the big plan. They are going to change everything. That plan is so big that the bank will not exist in the current state in another 2 years if just we could get a little more money and a little more manpower working on the big plan. So what that usually is a innovation lab that has dedicated itself to some form of tech. And they are thoroughly all in, 100% all in on that tech. And that tech will have profound relationship to changing the institution. Now, it's a great goal. But the reality is all during this period, the lab doesn't show any forward motion in innovation. It doesn't have any small successes that it can keep, that it can point to. And the entire staff is dedicated to this one very, very super large mission rather than a series of small successes that come one after the other, which is the more favorable and the more productive way of running a lab.
Right. And I think that plays into one of your other points, too, and that is that internal teams should think more about transformation rather than disruption. Share your thoughts on that a little bit.
Oh, yeah, sure. One of the problems that I see over and over is, and this is not the, and I'll preface this by saying it's not the fault of young people being young and being digitally savvy, but there's sort of an insensitivity that many labs run around within their organization, and they say, well, we're going to disrupt. Fine. You're talking to a 18-year or 20-year veteran of the bank who's got a career that has vested in the institution, and you tell them that you're going to disrupt their operation, their sales team, their
right.
group. And, you know, it doesn't make for a lot of friends. And I think oftentimes that the people in the innovation lab business are insensitive to the fact that when they talk about disruption, what other people are hearing is job loss. I'm being laid off. I've done something wrong. I haven't kept my group current with what's going on. So what I always tell labs is, please use the disruption word as infrequently as possible and use transformation. Transformation is a better word because it's really what you want to do. You want to transform from a non-digital operation to a digital operation. You don't necessarily want to disrupt everyone and everything around you. It's a loaded word that may cause more harm than good.
Well, and like so many other hot buzzwords in our industry right now, it's one of the most misused words. And I can't tell you how many times I hear a bank executive say, well, you know, you have to disrupt yourself before somebody else disrupts you. And that's not actually the right thing. You don't want to disrupt yourself, to your point. You want to transform yourself. You want to give yourself options. You also want to keep the existing business going as long as you can because it has certain built-in advantages to the structure that you already have. And so from the C-suite's perspective, from the shareholder's perspective, it's not about disrupting yourself. It is about trying new ideas. And then and even the transformation word, I mean, arguably that happens, you know, more often than it used to, but that's still not a, you know, we don't transform ourselves every other year or something. That's a pretty long-term kind of target.
You know, it's really interesting. if you don't make your staff happy, and if your staff, your existing staff that's built your current business, if you don't transfer successfully their IP into the digital world, you've got nothing. So let me take a step back and re-explain this. Your staff, your current staff, is the gold mine. They are the people who contain the information that needs to be transformed and put into some form of digital fashion. So if these people are not on board, and if these people are not made an integral part of this exercise, there's nothing left. What can you go digital with if you lose or do not have the fantastic resources that have built your company for many years? So saying you have to disrupt yourself is really scary business. Transformation and taking the IP that you have and transforming it into something new, that's a wonderful goal and a more attainable goal.
Right. I think Clayton Christensen coined the phrase well back in 1997 when he called it the innovator's dilemma. And people get the disruption part. They know the stories about Kodak and Blockbuster and Nokia and so on. But it is a dilemma because I've got a real life business and real life customers generating profits this quarter. So how do I keep that going while I'm also trying to transform myself?
Yeah, absolutely. There is a timing issue that we have to deal with. And many businesses, including banks, may be disrupted, sure, but there will be this gray period in between. And it's that in-between period that we have to deal with. And we have to take the IP of the people who are currently in your bank and transform that into a digital package somehow. And that's going to be not something that's done over 2 weeks. It's something that's going to be done over a number of years. And there's going to be a large transitional period before you get there. And keeping your staff happy and keeping your existing operations going, that's going to be key. And the managers who can do that and make that transformation, I think are going to be well rewarded, but it's far and few between.
Well, it is a balancing act. You also talk about one of your best practices is using discipline project management. And in my experience, I would argue that banks are maybe a little bit too good at discipline project management because they want everything to have a project charter and an owner and a budget and a Gantt chart and everything else. And innovation doesn't always work that way. So what is discipline project management in the scope of a digital innovation lab in the way that we've been talking about it today?
Oh boy, that's probably the toughest. That's probably the toughest question.
How about
I wrote the book, but I have no idea. No, yeah. The answer is really it's hard. Basically, innovation loathes a schedule. So there's no innovation project that I've ever worked on that didn't have a delay or didn't have some problem associated with it. And, you know, and that's normal. And you're right. So, again, this goes, if you put an innovation project under the Gantt system and under the very, very detailed project management that some banks may have, yeah, it's not going to fit because the activities don't happen on schedule. Innovation doesn't happen on a timeline.
Right.
So the simple answer is you need to have, I think more important than the timeline is the sensation of when to pull the plug. When is some project not working, even if it's ahead of schedule or within the allotted time? Do you burn all of your time on a project if you've got a really good hunch that it's this thing isn't working out early on? And to me, the discipline project management is knowing when to, is more about when to call it quits.
I think the other thing you talk about that I definitely agree with is you just talk about learning, right? Are we still learning? Are we learning something? We may have not have hit a deadline that we thought we were going to hit up front, but if we stopped learning, that's certainly time to stop a project as well. So Rich, maybe last question here. I've cited some of the best practices that you have in your book, but give us at a high level, what are these best practices really all about?
Sure. I'm delighted you asked that because I'm not trying to make rules for your lab. In fact, I was very clear. I thought about this. I didn't want to make a rule-based system because labs are all so different that you could not have one set of rules that would work for all innovation labs. But best practices are essentially things that you can do that if they apply to you can make your lab environment run more smoothly. And what's behind each best practice is essentially a conversation. Now, let me make this clear. The stakeholders in your innovation lab, there are essentially three. There are obviously more, but the three big ones are going to be the lab employees, the senior management who sponsors the lab, and the people from the business units who have to use the lab. Now, what the best practices are all designed to do is to start an organized discussion between these stakeholders. So basically, just imagine the scenario where the lab people are having some problem. They pick up the book, they go to best practice number 7, and they say, hey, our problem right now has this problem. You can give the book to the other shareholders, say, can you please read chapter 7? And basically, it starts a discussion. So the best practices, each one of them is a discussion to be had among the shareholders that hopefully makes the lab experience better for everyone.
I think these are all good best practices for anybody running an innovation lab. And I think people should definitely read your book, Innovation Lab Excellence, Digital Transformation from Within. Richard Turin, how can people get the book or learn more about you?
Sure. The book is available on Amazon and more about me on richturin.com. That's, and the Turin part has two R's.
That's
Turin. So Tango, Uniform, Romeo, India, November in pilot speak.
Very, very good use of the NATO alphabet there. As Nichols with no H, I try to get people's names right. So Richard Turin with two R's, thanks for joining us on Breaking Banks.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Well, thanks to our guests this week, and please do join in on the conversation on Twitter. We always appreciate your feedback, questions, and suggestions. We're at BreakingBanks1 on Twitter, or you can email us at info@provoke.fm. And also reach out if you're interested in sponsoring a show or a segment. Our sponsors make the show possible and often provide really great content. If you like the show, please do give us a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast platform. If you still want more, you can listen and download to more than 300 shows from Breaking Banks and our other shows like FinTech 5, Serial Entrepreneur, Breaking Banks Asia Pacific with Simon Spencer, all at provoke.fm. That's it for this week, and we'll see you again next week with more Breaking Banks.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.